White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. We're glad you've joined us tonight, September 19, 2013, for Chapter 60. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And we're in a good mood tonight. And you know, Hadding, every chapter has something in it that makes it special, seems to me. And even for those who think they know everything, there's something to learn, something new to learn, and this one is no exception. I learned a few things, and it is titled, How Jewish International Finance Functions.
Yeah.
All right, and it's it's not super long, but it's a fairly long one, so should we just get started?
All right, Chapter 60, How Jewish International Finance Functions. Such has been the development of international bankers that they can no longer be regarded in their professional capacity as the nationals of any country entitled to do business under their own government's supervision exclusively. They are really world citizens with worldwide interests, and as such ought to be made amenable to some form of supranational control. George Petullo in the Saturday Evening Post.
How come nobody listened to him?
I don't know.
That was pretty good. I wonder, I'd like to see just how that was written in the Saturday Evening Post. It was some little thing in the corner or is a big story anyway.
Well, actually, you know, the solution to these things is on the national level. You just make sure that all of your business and finance is not international. You know, that way you don't have to worry about all that. If you make it international control, then you've got to entrust that power to somebody, and probably the bankers will end up controlling that.
Yeah.
All right. Not only did the Jewish financial firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company use far-sighted prudence in splitting its political support, one Warburg supporting Wilson, another Warburg supporting Taft, and an unnamed member of the firm supporting Roosevelt, all at one time, as Paul M. Warburg testified. But it split its activities in several other ways also. The international interests of the Jews comprising this firm are worthy of note. The influence which forced the United States to repudiate a commercial treaty with Russia, while Russia was a friendly country in 1911, and thus to compel all business between the United States and Russia to pass through German Jewish hands, was generated by Jacob H. Schiff. Russia seems to have been the country on which he chose to focus his activities. The full story is told in the Dearborn Independent of January 15, 1921, under the title, Taft Once Tried to Resist the Jews and Failed, and is reprinted in Volume 2 of the booklet containing this series. Mr. Schiff's activity consisted in forcing the Congress of the United States to do a thing that was repugnant to the reason and conscience of President Taft, and which he personally refused to do or to recommend. Mr. Schiff left the White House in great anger with the threat, "This means war!" It did not mean as much war as it might have, for President Taft acquiesced gracefully in the Jewish victory, and has since been extremely laudatory of them, on the public platform. Mr. Schiff's firm also helped finance the Japanese war against Russia, and in return desired Japan as a Jewish ally. The wily Japs, however, saw the game and kept their relations with Mr. Schiff to purely business matters. Which fact is well worth bearing in mind when reading the widespread propaganda for war with Japan. If you will give particular attention, you will observe that the same interests, which are just now engaged in most loudly defending the Jew, are most active in spreading anti-Japanese sentiments in this country.
Well, just think about what that's saying. It says they were spreading propaganda for war with Japan. They can actually bring about war with people. They bring about all these wars. It's obvious. And so, you know, when they don't like something, they decide they're going to cause a war to be fermented against you. Fomented, I guess. Yeah, and that's enough to scare people when they see that they've actually succeeded in doing it. And that so they figure it's easier to acquiesce. And that makes these people really international gangsters in worse words than that. It's shocking.
Well, they're able to get away with it more easily because there's a tendency for people who are not the immediate victim of this kind of persecution from Jews to stand aside or
right.
even help. Like, for example, Syria in the 1990-91 war against Iraq, Syria sent 15,000 troops to help out. But now Syria's number is coming up.
There you go. I don't know why they would have done that.
Well, Syria.
But they get their, you know, it was the United States, you know, pushing them to do it, and they feel they had to do something, so they gave something, you know. That's in these international relations, and if you're a recipient of aid and so on, and you're getting a few things that you need, you have to do, you know, you have to pay the piper when you're called up to do so.
Well, there are a lot of little petty animosities between the countries over there, but it was very short-sighted on the part of Assyrians to help with destroying Iraq, I would say, and the other countries there as well.
Yeah. Right.
The Japanese war with Russia, however, enabled Mr. Schiff to advance his plan to undermine the Russian Empire, as it has now been accomplished by Jewish Bolshevism. With funds provided by him, the basic principles of what is now known as Bolshevism were sown among the Russian prisoners of war in Japan, who were sent back as apostles of destruction. Then followed the horrible murder of Nicholas Romanov, Tsar of Russia, with his wife, his crippled son, and his young daughters, the full tale of which has now been told by the Jew who managed the crime. For the part he played in destroying Russia, Mr. Schiff was wildly hailed in New York the night the news came that the emperor had abdicated.
Meanwhile, you know, think about that. Just think about that. You know, how ignorant are people anyway? Well, they are all, in New York, you may have been talking about Jews. It was all Jews in New York doing that. But they had so managed to get people to think that the Tsar of Russia was an evil tyrant, you know, that they thought it was considered a good thing that he was off the throne and they're going to have something more democratic going on. Anyway.
Meanwhile, the Jew who was to take the Tsar's job, as the common New York ghetto phrase ran weeks before the event, had left New York to be in waiting.
They never name him, but then they're speaking of Trotsky.
Yes. Correct? Yeah. Trotsky, who had an acting career in New York and appeared in some films.
Well, he didn't even live in New York very long.
Yeah.
I used to think he was born there and he was actually a New Yorker, but he wasn't. He was a Russian and Russian Jew. Yeah. And, he came over to the U.S. and spent a few months and then it was time for him to go back.
Yeah, it's amazing how Jews can come over here and immediately have a career in Hollywood or whatever.
Okay.
This Jew was passed out of the United States at the request of a very high American personage whose subservience to the Jews was one of the marvels of the past 7 years. Halted by the British, this Jew was released from their toils at the request of a very high American personage. I believe he was stopped in Newfoundland.
Well, who was this very high American personage? Do you have any clue?
I don't remember.
They don't say. I didn't do any work researching into that, but I wonder if it's the same very high American personage. They mention it twice, the same one who's...
I just remember that Trotsky was detained in Newfoundland, where his ship stopped. And then somebody from the United States intervened, and he was allowed to go on.
Yeah, somebody very high up.
Yeah. And thus, the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, the program of which was made in America, was set in operation without a hitch. This whole firm is German Jewish, its members having originated in Germany. It had German connections. How far it maintained those connections through all subsequent events is a separate question. Mr. Otto Kahn's allotted portion of the world seems to be Great Britain and France. Mr. Kahn is of German origin, like the rest of the firm, but he has not publicly shown such concern for Germany as have the other members. Mr. Schiff was once very active for the settlement of a peace on the basis of a victorious Germany. Mr. Paul M. Warburg also had interests, discussion of which is postponed for the present. But Mr. Kahn succeeded, through the connivance of American authority and the excessive repression of the newspapers, in conveying the impression that by some species of occult separatism, he was not German-minded. Therefore, Mr. Kahn flits lightly everywhere, except Germany. He is sufficiently French to be able to tell in the first column, on the first page of Le Matin, on what terms America will do business with Europe, and he speaks as one having authority. He is sufficiently British to have thought of standing for the British Parliament when an unfortunate event made it necessary for him to remain in the United States.
Yeah, that was covered in more detail in a previous chapter.
Yeah.
People remember. I want to go back and look for it.
Mr. Kahn sometimes flits farther east into the more Jewish portions of Europe, and his comings and goings are marked by certain changes with which his name remains most ostentatiously disconnected. Mr. Kahn has very recently been telling France on what terms the United States will help her. There apparently being no other spokesman, Mr. Kahn's word is accepted as authority. France is one of the most Judaized countries in the world, the haunt of international Jewish financiers who exercise their power, thus saving France the trouble of passing laws, to keep the emigrant Jew out of France, so that France presents the spectacle of being Judaized by Jewish finance and not by immigrant Semitic hordes, and is thus a fit platform from which Mr. Otto Hermann Kahn may utter his pronouncements. In his last declaration to France, Mr. Kahn prepares her to expect little by stating that America is a country of immense resources, but the actual money which the people have at their disposal is comparatively limited. True enough, it was a member of Mr. Kahn's firm who invented a monetary system which was promised to keep money in more equal relation to wealth. But as he goes on telling what America will and will not do, the American people knowing nothing about it meanwhile, Mr. Kahn discovers with great enthusiasm a place where he thinks American capital can be placed, namely, in the development of the vast and immensely rich colonial empire of France. And pray, where is that? Any Frenchman would tell you now, in Syria. In Syria, that part of the East, where the natives are loudly complaining that the Jews are driving them out contrary to every written and moral law. The Jewish powers have already succeeded in getting French troops over there. Bad blood has been caused between France and Great Britain. The Jews on both sides are playing for the middle, and here is Mr. Otto Kahn himself pledging American capital to the development of the French colonial empire.
Yeah, the colonial empire, not the French nation or some kind of friendship thing, but, you know, pledging capital to the French colonial empire, that means what, northern Africa and so on?
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk to these Jews doing this, okay.
Talk to any Syrian who knows his country's present status, and he will interpret Mr. Kahn's words very vividly. One of the nicest bits of work Mr. Kahn has done is to denounce pro-German propaganda, which he says has exasperated Americans in favor of France. Next to committing the United States to an undying admiration for Briand, this is really his finest bit, especially with partner Paul playing the German sympathy string. There's a great international orchestra, this Jewish financial firm. It can play the Star-Spangled Banner, Die Wacht am Rhein, La Marseillaise, and God Save the Queen.
The King.
In one harmonious rendering, paying obsequious attention to the prejudices of each.
Yeah, so along with splitting themselves among the presidential candidates, as which was talked about last week in this firm, Kuhn, Loeb & Company, they all supported a different presidential candidate and gave contributions. They're pointing out that they also split themselves among the European nations in who they are sympathetic and helpful toward.
Next come the Warburgs. Their interest is, of course, in Germany. Paul stated in his testimony given at the beginning of the World War that he had interests in Hamburg and would dispose of them. The war came on. The Jewish government in the United States was augmented. Mr. Warburg was no mean figure, as previous articles have shown. The Warburgs are three in number. Felix M. is the other one in America. He appears but slightly in public affairs, although he is a member of the American Jewish Committee and of the firm of Kuhn, Loeb & Company. His retiring habit, however, does not argue lack of consequence. He was of sufficient consequence, Jewishly, to have bestowed upon him a sort of honorary rabbinical degree of Haber, which entitles him to be known as Haber Rabbi Baruch Ben Moshe. He is the only Jew in America upon whom the title has ever been conferred. Max Warburg represents the family in its native land, Germany. Max Warburg had as much to do with the German war government as his family and financial colleagues in America had to do with the United States war government. As has been recounted in the press the world over, the brother from America and the brother from Germany both met at Paris as government representatives in determining the peace. There were so many Jews in the German delegation that it was known by the term kosher, also as the Warburg delegation. And there were so many Jews in the American delegation that the delegates from the minor countries of Europe looked upon the United States as a Jewish country which, through unheard-of generosity, had elected a non-Jew as its president. Max Warburg is an interesting character, also as regards the establishment of Bolshevism in Russia. The Jews had several objectives in the war, and one of them was get Russia. To this end, the German Jews worked very assiduously. Because Russia was a member of the Allies, the work of German Jews was made the easier. But the fact that Russia was an ally made no difference with the Jews who were resident in the Allied countries. Win or lose, Russia must be destroyed. It is the testimony of history that it was not so much the German military prowess as the Jewish intrigue that accomplished the downfall of that empire. In this work, Max Warburg was a factor. His bank is noted in a dispatch published by the United States government as being one whence funds were forwarded to Trotsky for use in destroying Russia. Always against Russia, not for German reasons, but for Jewish reasons, which in this particular instance coincided. Warburg and Trotsky against Russia.
Yeah, I think they're pointing out there the very wealthy Warburg, big, fancy banker, and this little nobody revolutionary Trotsky working together.
Huh. Yep. Poor John Spargo, who ought to know better, denies all this, while every American who comes back from Russia, even those who went over there pro-Bolshevik, yes, and returned Jews themselves, proclaim it.
Now, for anybody who might want to know who John Spargo is, which I did because I didn't know, so I looked it up and I can tell you that where they're talking about someone who is described as a promising and energetic Marxist agitator in Britain, where he was born and grew up, and created something like an amalgam of Christian socialism and Marxism, seeking the brotherhood of man by following the true principles of the Man of Galilee. So, you know, he had the Christian aspect in there, while embracing science and the belief in the rule of the working class as the motive force to create social change. Well, he came to America in 1901, and he became quite well known. He became a member of the Socialist Party, and then he started with some other people another party after he left that, and he was pro-war. You know, a very strange kind of guy. But basically, and he wrote one of the best books, it said, on Marxism.
Yeah. Well, he wrote, I believe, a biography of Marx.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
The crushing fact is that Bolshevism is not only Jewish in Russia and in America, but it is Jewish in the higher regions of Jewry, where better things ought to exist. Here we go again, wishing for the good Jews to show themselves.
Yeah, I agree. I thought this was unnecessary to say that, but they do.
Take Walter Rathenau, a German Jew on the plain of the Warburgs. Rathenau was the inventor of the Bolshevik system of centralization of industry, material, and money. The Soviet government asked Rathenau directly for the plans and received them directly from him. Max Warburg's bank held the money. Walter Rathenau's mind held the plans, which makes it a pertinent question. If Bolshevism can be so Jewish outside of Russia, what hinders it being Jewish inside Russia? Well,
yeah, come on.
What the Jews will say is that, I mean, some Jews anyway, is that the Mensheviks were a lot more Jewish.
Yeah,
than
you've told us that. Something.
Bolsheviks. The rank and file Bolsheviks were mostly not Jews. But
well,
the
they're asking this here. Let's just see what they say.
All right. If Bolshevism can be so Jewish outside of Russia, what hinders it being Jewish inside Russia? Yeah, it was like 6 months ago that I discussed that. Not everybody's going to remember what I said. It is a most significant fact that, as in Washington, the most constant and privileged visitors to the White House were Jews. So in Berlin, the only private telephone wire to the Kaiser was owned by Walter Rathenau. Not even the Crown Prince could reach the Kaiser except through the ordinary telephone connections. It was the same in London. It was the same in Paris. It was the same in Petrograd, in Russia, which so persecuted the race that controlled it then and controls it now.
Well, that's pretty amazing, though, that if this is true, that the only private telephone wire in Berlin to the Kaiser was owned by this Jewish, where he's supposed to be some kind of an economist, wasn't he? Banker, economist. That's pretty shocking. Not even the Crown Prince had that.
Mm-hmm.
They say the Kaiser wasn't real impressed by his Crown Prince, though.
Now, this sketchy outline of the internationalism of the firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company is not offered as the result of keen research, for the facts are found on the very surface of the matter, for anyone to see. What is revealed by research is this. Whether Mr. Schiff's interest in Russia had underground features which affected the welfare of the nations, whether Mr. Kahn's flitting missions here and there, which he made with great freedom during the war, were wholly taken up with the business announced in the public notices, and whether Mr. Warburg, whose interest in Germany has not abated, to judge from his recent utterances, was able to retain complete neutrality of mind during the war. These are questions of value. Obviously, they are not easy to answer, but they can be answered. It was a family enterprise, this international campaign. Jacob Schiff swore to destroy Russia. Paul M. Warburg was his brother-in-law. Felix Warburg was his son-in-law. Max Warburg of Hamburg, banker of the Bolsheviks, was thus brother-in-law to Jacob Schiff's wife and daughter.
Hmm.
Speaking of the far-sighted manner in which the house of Kuhn, Loeb and Company disposes itself over world affairs, there is also the curious fact that in this Jewish firm is one who goes to a Christian church. A most heinous thing for a Jew to do.
split three ways in American politics and as many ways as international matters require, we find this firm split two ways with regard to religion. Mr. Kahn professes, at least he attends, a Christian church, and is accounted an adherent of it. Yet he is not ostracized. His name is not taboo. The Jews do not curse him. He is not denounced as a renegade. The Jews have not buried him out of mind, as they do others who desert the faith.
Well, I think they're referring here to what it was some weeks ago, quite a few, that we had those chapters about Israel in the, 19, well, when they were, whenever that was, when it was trying to get its identity. And remember we had those wild stories about what they did to fellow Jews who didn't follow exactly.
Trying to keep them from attending schools with non-Jews and so forth.
Yeah, just little things, and they just, denounce them horribly. But see, it depends on who you are, and this is not in Israel either.
This is a different group of Jews, possibly with a different orientation.
Right.
I have to say it may not be fair to say that or to imply that Kuhn Loeb and company were some kind of hypocrites because they were not as bigoted religiously as Jews over in Palestine who were trying to build a Jewish state. I mean, those were fanatics that went to Palestine.
Yeah, well, I'm just pointing out the difference, and that when they're pointing it out here, the writers are pointing it out.
But, I mean, what they're insinuating is that that it's insincere, that Kahn's Christianity was insincere. He was, I believe, buried in a Catholic cemetery.
You know what, though, Hadding? The way he did all this work for Jewish benefit, which that whole firm did, internationally, means that he was a kind of a hypocrite. So he was outwardly a Christian, like a lot of them do that, but he was working for Jewish interests, for sure, in that firm. So I think that's, the point to be made here.
Yeah, well...
Yeah.
Of course, the main goal of a firm like Kuhn Loeb and Company is to make more money.
Okay.
This presents a strange situation when it is considered. Not to recount again the horror and reprehension and active antagonism with which Jews view such a desertion, suffice it to say that there is no greater marvel than that of Jacob H. Schiff retaining in the firm of Kuhn Loeb & Company a renegade Jew. He could not have done it. Every fiber of his intensely Jewish nature would have rebelled against it. Yet, there he is.
There it is. Well, they're still going on that. They're saying that if he wasn't a Jew for Jews, he wouldn't have been in that firm.
Yeah, I don't think that's a very good argument.
Well, it makes sense to me.
Yeah, okay.
But I understand. It's,
There's some good arguments in here and some that I don't think are quite so good. Without going further into this ingenious system of covering all vital points from one center, enough has been said to show one busy Jewish financial firm with which political matters, national and international, is almost a profession. The family of Warburg, high in the controlling group of two countries, and enemy countries at that. The family of Warburg, high in the negotiations of world peace and the discussions of a League of Nations. The family of Warburg, now advising the world from both sides of the earth what to do next. It was probably with more reason than the general public surmised that a New York paper printed during the peace conference an article headed, "Watch the Warburgs."
Hey, I'm wondering if if Goldman Sachs could be considered something similar to what Kuhn Loeb and Company was back then.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, they're certainly totally international. They deal in political things. They in fact, met people, partners from there become the Secretary of the Treasury more often than not in the United States government. How do, you know, these things, they have these patterns, and they're so obvious, and yet nobody will say a word about it. As we know, you know, with the Federal Reserve chairman now always being Jewish, they don't pick from anybody but Jews, yet nobody says a word about it. It's shocking. You know, I mean, just the lack of talk is noticeable, you know. What would be normal? Normal to say, but.
Hey, you know what's another Jew that converted to Catholicism? The gangster Dutch Schultz. I read about that on Wikipedia. I forget exactly what it was, but it's like with Christianity, he was able to give up, I don't know, he was able to overcome something. I don't remember what it was.
He was German.
He was a Jew. Dutch Schultz.
I know he's a Jew.
That wasn't his real name at all.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. See how they fool you? Dutch Schultz.
Schultz was somebody else's name that he took. The fact seems to be that, as Mr. Petullo is quoted as saying at the head of this article, the international financiers have been so engrossed in world money that the sense of national responsibility sometimes becomes blurred in their minds. They desire everything, war, negotiations, and peace, to be conducted in such a way as to react favorably on the money market. For that is their market. Money is what they buy and sell. And because money has no fixed price, it is a market which offers the widest opportunity for the trickster and swindler. One cannot play such tricks with stone or corn or metals, but with money as the commodity, everything is possible. Well, here, this is kind of an argument for metal-backed money, which I think is not really such a good idea.
Well, at that time, yeah, they spoke well about gold.
Yeah. More likely silver, but you know.
Yeah.
I think there's a chapter in the International Jew about how gold is not the.
Really?
There's a chapter about how the Jews own a disproportionate amount of gold in the world, and that having a gold-backed currency was in favor of the Jews or something like that. You know, William Jennings Bryan gave that famous cross of gold.
Sure. Is this a chapter coming up yet, huh?
I believe so, yeah.
I didn't remember noticing it, so I'll have to take another look.
Mr. Warburg is already very much interested about the treatment to be accorded foreign securities in the next war. Readers of the daily newspapers may recall that recently a demand was made for the gold in the Reichsbank, which was resisted on the ground that the Reichsbank, although the central bank of Germany, was really a private concern, just as Paul Warburg said it was, and just as he has insisted that our own Federal Reserve system should be, and which it is. There is far-sighted wisdom in that, with a view to possible defeat in the war. Mr. Warburg is apparently quite disapproving of the treatment accorded alien enemy property by some countries. He quotes a French banker throughout, nationality not stated, and drives home his point. The French banker used as an illustration a possible war between England and France, this was only last year, and said that the bankers in each country would proceed to withdraw their mutual balances and securities for fear of confiscation, and that such a course would precipitate a panic. To which Mr. Warburg adds,
I think that our bankers ought carefully to study this very serious question. We have nothing to gain and much to lose by joining in a policy of disregarding the rights of private property. We shall probably, in the course of time, become the largest owners of foreign securities and properties, which would become endangered in case we were drawn into war. To me, however, it is of greater interest that nothing be done that might stand in the way of making the United States the gold reserve country of the world. Such talk passes with too little scrutiny. It bears a strong reflection of recent events, which should not be overlooked. Moreover, it presents a grandiose vision which is supposed to command instant agreement because of its appeal to superficial national pride and selfish ambition. If, yeah, we get these appeals to national pride used to lure us off to fight wars for Israel, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what's he saying here anyway? What's he saying? What is he saying about gold?
Says it, that Warburg wants the United States to be the gold reserve country of the world.
Well, who was the gold reserve country at that time?
I don't know.
Yeah, obviously not the United
States. Britain.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Britain acquired a lot of gold and silver from India in the early stages of conquest and plunder in India.
They just took it, huh?
Yeah, there were vast hoards of precious metals in India from Roman times. But, of course, today the United States dollar is the reserve currency of the world, which some countries are working at eliminating.
Right.
If what Mr. Warburg says is an intimation that the international Jews are planning to move their money market to the United States, it is safe to say that the United States does not want it. We have the warning of history as to what this would mean. It has meant that in turn, Spain, Venice, Great Britain, or Germany received the blame and suspicion of the world for what the Jewish financiers have done. It is a most important consideration that most of the national animosities that exist today arose out of resentment against what the Jewish money power did under the camouflage of national names. The British did this. The Germans did this. When it was the international Jew who did it, the nations being but the marked spaces on his checkerboard.
Well, I think they were talking in earlier parts of the book that the international Jewish financial markets were centered in Germany before they were moved to the United States, right before war. You know, right before the wars. I don't remember now if it was the first war or the second war. I think it was between the first and the second wars they moved everything to the United States, because they already, and that was a sign, or you know, an indication that they knew what they were going to do to Germany, and that was going to be destroyed. So they, you know, got everything
out
of there.
Well, my understanding was that the international currency exchange was in London.
Well, the currency exchange may, but I think they're talking here about...
London was pretty much the financial capital of the world in the 19th
century. Yeah, but they're talking about the international Jewish center, you know, where they had their... Where is that? It's a little up higher, I guess. But where they had their, they were headquartered in Germany, and they moved to the United States.
Today, around the world, the blaming word is heard. The United States did this. If it were not for the United States, the world would be in better shape. The Americans are a sordid, greedy, cruel people. Why? Because the Jewish money power is largely centered here and is making money out of both our immunity and Europe's distress, playing one against the other. And because so many of the so-called American businessmen abroad today are not Americans at all. They are Jews, and in many cases as misrepresentative of their own race as they are of the Americans.
Well, you know, here they're talking about how the United States, because it's where the Jews are functioning from with their money, is looked upon in a negative light, that back then, in 1921, and we know how it is today. Today, America is hated so much all around the world.
Right.
And why? It's all because these Jews are running the country. These
Jewish
Jews are running everything.
Yeah, especially foreign policy.
Yeah, in every area, really, yes. But, I mean, it's all because of, we're hated because of the Jews. There you go.
The United States does not want the transfer of all Judan to this soil. We do not desire to stand as a gold god above the nations. We would serve the nations, and we would protect them. But we would do both in the basis of real values, not in the name or under the sign of gold. On the one hand, Mr. Warburg recites pitiful facts about Germany in order to raise sympathy for her. And, on the other hand, he stimulates the gold lust of the United States. The plight of Germany is entirely due to the forces from which the United States has only narrowly escaped. And to hearken to international Jewish plans for the rehabilitation of Germany is to be in danger of approving plans which will fasten Jewish domination more strongly on that unhappy country than it is now. So it would be out of the frying pan into the fire if you take the Jewish plan for rehabilitating Germany. Germany has paid dearly for her Jews. The Warburg voice that speaks for her would seem indeed to be the voice of Jacob, but the hand that proposes financial dealings is that of Esau. The internationalism of the Warburgs is no longer in doubt and cannot be denied. Felix Warburg hung on to the Hamburg connection longer than did Paul, but the breakage of either was probably perfunctory. At the same time that Felix left the Hamburg firm of his brother Max, a Mr. Stern also left the Frankfurt firm of Stern, and both became very active on the Allies' side, taking sides against the German nation as lustily as anyone could. Impossible, say those who fancy that a German Jew is a German. Not at all impossible. The Jew's loyalty is to the Jewish nation. What the Jew himself refers to as his cover nationality may count or not as he himself elects. This statement is always met with frothing wrath by the Jews' Gentile fronts in the purchased pro-Jewish press. But here is an example. Do you remember the Beast of Berlin, that lurid piece of war propaganda? You did not perhaps know that its producer was a German Jew, Karl Lemle. His German birth did not prevent him making money out of his film, and his film does not prevent him annually going back in state to his birthplace. This year he goes accompanied by Abe Stern, his treasurer, Lee Kolmar, his director, and Harry Reichenbach, a list of names duplicable in any movie group.
Well, let me just say something. Oh, go ahead.
In other words, the movie industry is all Jews.
Yes, yeah. Right. And looking up this Karl Lemle, who, as you reminded me, we've talked about before, but, you know, this particular film, I wasn't sure what it was, and it had it was not just the Beast of Berlin, it was Kaiser Wilhelm, the Beast of Berlin. And it says here in a review of it, it came out in 1918, you know, at the end of the first war. It was a blockbuster when it was released, and Universal spared no expense in advertising their mega hit. Carl Laemmle pushed the film to the theater owners as hard as he sold it to the viewing public. This German Jew. And this, all this film did, it said it wasn't, there was a photoplay review of it. You know, photoplay was a movie, well, it was a movie magazine later, but it was some kind of movie industry thing. And in a review there, it said that it wasn't really a play, but it was a statement of war crimes against Kaiser Wilhelm and the German nation. I mean, it's just pure propaganda. They showed the Kaiser in a kind of the way Charlie Chaplin did with Adolf Hitler, you know, just making fun of him and as an evil creature. Yeah.
I don't think the Beast of Berlin was humorous, though.
Yeah, well, I don't know. See, I would like to see it. Yeah, probably wasn't. It wasn't the same way. I get. Well, when you see pictures of this actor playing him, it looks kind of like it's humorous. But I guess they were very serious about it. It was just a propaganda thing about war crimes, trying to make people see him as a war.
Messrs. Stern and Warburg of Frankfurt and Hamburg, respectively, and away from home perhaps only temporarily, were not concerned about the fate of the Huns, but they were immensely concerned about the fate of Jewish money power in Germany. To indicate how blind the public has been to the inter-allied Jewish character of much of the world's important international financial activity, note this from the Living Age earlier in the year. According to the Svensk Handelstidning, the recent American loan of $5 million to Norway was really the outcome of an agreement between the Hamburg firm of Warburg and Company and the New York bankers Kuhn and Loeb. It is regarded as a significant sign of the times that a German firm should be responsible for an American loan to a neutral country. The conditions subject to which this money was borrowed are not regarded as very favorable to Norway, and no marked effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries has followed. Note, in the light of all the statements made about Kuhn, Loeb and Company, and the Warburgs in particular, the assumption in the above quotation that the transaction was really between a German and an American firm. It was principally an arrangement between the Warburgs themselves, in family council. But the loan will pass in Norway as an American loan, and the fact that the terms of the loan are not regarded as very favorable to Norway will react upon Scandinavian opinion of this country. It goes without saying that no marked effect on the rate of exchange between the two countries has followed, for that would not be the object of such a loan. The dislocation of exchange is not unprofitable. It would be most interesting to know in how far Kuhn, Loeb and Company has endeavored to readjust the rate of exchange. During the war, Kuhn, Loeb and Company made a loan to the city of Paris. Considerable German comment was occasioned by this, naturally. And it is very well worthy of record that in the city of Hamburg, where Max Warburg does business, the chief of police issued this order: further mention in the press of loans made by the firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company to the city of Paris and unfavorable comments thereon are forbidden. The following story is vouched for as reliable, and if in one or two minor details it does not represent the exact fact, it is a trustworthy illustration of how certain things were done. A Jewish international banking corporation bought up the mining and other similar concessions of Yugoslavia, and consequently the policy pushed at the peace conference was that which was most convenient for that group. An understanding on the Fiume question was in progress between Wilson and Nitti. Certain concessions had been agreed upon, and Wilson was willing to negotiate, when Oscar Strauss
and one of the Warburgs appeared on the scene. Wilson changed his attitude overnight, and afterward insisted on the Yugoslavia solution of the problem. The way in which concessions had been brought through that territory was a disgrace, and observers expected that it would play an important part at the peace conference. The financiers are not the only international Jews in the world. The revolutionary Jews of all countries and none are international also. They have seized upon the idea of Christian internationalism, which means amity between nations, and have used it as a weapon with which to weaken nationality. They know as well as anyone that there can be no internationalism except on the basis of strong nationalism, but they count on cover words to advance their plan. Enough transpired between the lower and higher Jewish groups of every large center during the war to render it imperative that Jewry confess, repent, and repudiate the madness that has ruled it, or else boldly assert and espouse it before the world. Certainly enough has transpired to render it desirable that the American people look again into the purposes of those Jews who were instrumental in reorganizing our financial system at a most critical time in the world's history. Max Warburg was apparently strong enough to suppress German discussion of his brother's activity in America. The Warburgs at present resident in America must suffer it, therefore, that American comment be made as full as need be.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice if it had been? Well, that was July 9th, 1921. I just got a couple minutes, or about a minute, so... But, you know, I think this thing up here, let me just say real quick that when they say that internationalism, you know, if nationalism, internationalism has to be founded on nationalism. You know, there can be no internationalism except on the basis of strong nationalism.
Well,
I think that's very good. You know, I mean, they talk about internationalism now like with no nationalisms, you know, that amount to anything.
Well, the same thing is true in psychology of individuals. You can't really know other people until you know yourself.
Huh. True.
You know?
Yeah. That's right. Well, knowing yourself is knowing everything, and so understanding nationalism is, I guess if you understand your own nation and love your own nation, you can accept other nations, too.
Well, you know? It's all, you know, it's like being a... Understanding yourself is sort of the first step toward being an integrated person and being able to function well. You know, it's the same. Nationalism is very similar to that. You know,
I think that's very good.
It starts with the sense of nationhood and having a realistic or at least some kind of idea of who the nation is.
Right. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be back next week with one more chapter about money. It will be Jewish Power and America's Money Famine. I'm just going to talk about what the Jews have done to us in America. Okay, see you next week.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.